talk about 20,000 years or 50,000 years of ceramics in 2.5 paracels, but I'll try to put it in some perspective. This first slide is a fragment or a shard of a piece of cuneiform found in Mesopotamia near Ur. It's about 6,000 years old. And I love broken shards like this because they seem to tell more than what they are. They kind of cause you to look beyond the piece itself. And it's a fragment of past civilizations. It's a fragment, a piece of man's past. We're all connected to that past. And pop shards are probably the only thing or one of the most important things that archaeologists look at to determine how a culture once lived, what they thought, and what they believed in. So pottery fragments or shards are very, very important. More important to archaeologists than ceramic art historians, perhaps, or even in the world of art, which brings up a point that there need to be more ceramic art historians to help describe pottery in the art context or aesthetics of ancient pottery, which there are only a handful of ceramic art historians in the whole United States, maybe 5 or 6 that are even specialized in that area. So most of the historical ceramics is kept away in basements and vaults and not really brought to light as far as being art objects. Some art objects are pretty obscure, like these fragments here. You can only kind of imagine what they might have been used for. So the archaeologist is mostly responsible for unearthing past pots from past civilizations. Then the world must be alive with pots and pot shards waiting to be discovered. And here, trying to reconstruct the fragments, we try to determine the shape or the use of the objects that were once made. A very important archaeological discovery, fairly recent, was in China from the Qin Dynasty. I don't know all the facts. I'm not a historian, so some things I don't include all the correct facts. I know this is in China. The discovery was in the 70s, so it's a very recent discovery, and perhaps one of the most important archaeological discoveries of all times was the discovery of this army of some 10,000 warriors that were buried with the Emperor Qin, who was the emperor of the first dynasty in China. He combined all the regions in China to form the one big empire. He's responsible for standardizing weights and measures, monetary system, writing system. He built the Great Wall. And when he was buried, he had this army created to protect him in the afterlife. And these army men, each one different, and in themselves are incredible ceramic objects. Some of them life-size objects, and maybe some of them weigh hundreds of pounds. They're all facing east towards their enemies in the east. Anyway, some 10,000 of these warriors, no two of them are identical. This horse weighs 500 pounds, so in itself is an incredible ceramic achievement as far as being able to make this and make so many of them.
That tour of the United States last
year. Yeah, I saw that. In fact, it was at Epcot. Nobody believed it was the real thing, but they had three figures there, and that was wonderful.
They also included like wooden pieces with them. They had like carts attached to some of these.
Yeah, there's an entire complete army, and they had bronze weapons at one time, but those were looted not long after. But anyway, magnificent, and these pieces are 2,000 years old. They were made in the 1st century B.C., and they're as good as if they just came out of the kiln. So this brings to light the possibilities that clay has as being a very durable material to record man's existence, more durable than any other material that man has been able to invent. For centuries or millennia, man's built his houses or dwellings out of clay, unfired adobe clay that's just dried, sun-baked clay. Works very well in climates that don't have, in arid climates that don't have lots of rain. Find these in New Mexico, where you might see the Sears or any building made out of adobe clay. And these buildings are decorated very much like the pots would then be decorated. Here's a mosque in Africa, a multi-story adobe dwelling. So these in themselves are like vessels and like pottery, very much like pottery. And they predate the making of fired pottery by thousands and thousands of years. Here are some grain storage granaries. When man became sedentary and he was no longer nomadic, he started to plant crops. He needed to store those crops and discovered that clay containers would be a good protection from rodents and other pests that might destroy his harvest. When clay was the natural material, let's take it, and if anybody's ever handled clay and it suddenly responds to your touch, and you can build fairly permanent unfired clay structures such as these. And then here's a fine example of what life could have been like many thousands of years ago, even though this is still happening in some parts of the world. But these vessels then were storing all of their belongings, clothes and grain, water, everything they need to protect them from rodents or any other animals that might try to steal or destroy their belongings. These round shapes are the most durable shapes. Rounded forms are much stronger and have less surface area. They're much easier to fire, easier to make. And so it just was natural that pots became kind of round vessel shapes. Clay is easy to fire when it's hollow. If you fire a solid piece of clay, it's going to blow up. So man early on discovered that if his pots were hollow, he could fire. So many different correlations that go along to the invention or discovery of making pottery. It's hard to say exactly who discovered it at what time. Pots still being used every day, and here's a good example of in Tunisia, these water jugs, which actually provide a cooling effect because the water seeping through and evaporating from the outside surface provides cold drinking water in areas that wouldn't otherwise have that convenience. And I always like to contrast things. This is the age of ceramics now, in our day and age, the high-tech ceramics, which might be compared to the making of jugs and jars thousands of years ago. That was high-tech stuff to make fire and pottery. And now this is our high technology, is fabricating these machining these precise clay parts that can withstand high temperatures and without abrasion. Show you a few more of these parts. These are motor engine parts that would be used in a combustion engine. Cylinders and valves. To me, these are beautiful art objects in themselves. And because they are high-fired carborundum-like material, they're going to withstand the test of time and will no doubt be around billions of years from now. Because these rocks are, these objects here have the same characteristics as granite or some of the stones of the earth that are billions of years old. So these objects are going to be around a long, long time.
That valve stem was made out of clay?
The ceramic material. Can't say it's clay as you would workable pottery clay, but it is ceramic. It's within the world of ceramics. It's probably a zirconium carborundum material.
So carborundum is ceramic?
Yeah, like carbon and silica.
So the carborundum. Bicycle frames, that's ceramic?
Yeah, those are ceramics. Those are some of the new materials that are being produced using ceramic materials.
All right.
Here's an example, a favorite of mine I got out of a magazine in Kyoto, Japan. It's a ceramic engine. And the caption underneath read that it's good for 500,000 miles. It's 200 miles per gallon. It operates at 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. It needs no oil for lubrication or no water cooling system. It's made out of ceramics, which is an inexhaustible source of materials on Earth. It's got a few metal parts in here, but the fact that it's ceramic makes it, you know, there's hope for the future that as we mine out our copper and nickel and zirconium, there's going to be materials to replace those things. But the fact that it can get 200 miles per gallon and last five times longer than a conventional automobile engine, it's just phenomenal to me. I'm very, very interested in that sort of ceramic engineering. Here's a hip bone transplant. And up to now, they've often used plastic or metal transplant parts, but here's a ceramic socket, and it will very easily integrate with the bone structure without an allergic reaction. So this is something that's being done, it's being used more and more in the medical field. There's something developed at my university called BioGlass, where they can repair a bone, a broken bone, with BioGlass, and the body will slowly dissolve that and replace that with bone material, so it can be a substitute for a badly damaged bone. Of course, the space program is only possible because of ceramics. And the computer chip, which is made from ceramic materials. It's actually a little circuit board printed on a silicon chip. So this day and age is really, more than we realize, is tied to the making of ceramic objects. Cement is considered ceramic. Our windows in our house are ceramic materials. We almost don't realize how connected we are with ceramics. But we think of ceramics as pottery, I think, mostly. Clay, the material necessary, the most abundant material on the surface of the earth. More clay is being produced geologically every day than we can possibly consume. This is a photograph of a kaolin mine in Japan. And clay, for most people, would look like rock, any other kind of rock. But to the geologist, clay has a very special quality that the crystalline structure is very flat, plate-like shape, so that when it's wet, the platelets tend to cling together, such as a wet deck of cards. And it's that crystalline structure that allows clay to be workable, that quality of plasticity. Here's some clay mined in a different fashion. The way clay has probably been mined for thousands of years. Tiny little tunnels dug into the earth to retrieve pure, fine clay. The potters are pretty particular about the clay they use. Bringing it back to the studio. Much different than Americans would think when we get clay on either a semi-truck or a trailer or a railroad car. Bringing the clay back and processing. These are some from Tunisia, where the potters are very careful about the clay they mine, and they sort out the various clays, and they allow it to first dry, bone dry, then they can process it. Some pictures from Libya, where they're processing clay. They're putting it in a big trough of water, and the clay will instantly dissolve within a short while. And he's crushing up the bits of clay, sorting out the rocks, and getting the impurities out of the clay. You can notice a little square box on the side there that's got a window screen in it. This gentleman is going to pass all that liquid clay through that screen into the next pond, where it will be more or less purified, and after a period of time the water will be taken away, the clay has settled, and it will be workable. So without any kinds of machines, here these people can produce a workable clay body. As in the old guild system in Europe, the potter, the apprentice, if you wanted to learn the craft of potter, you would go and study with the master potter. And here's an example of the young apprentice wedging clay for the potter. And traditionally, the apprentice would wedge clay for 5 years before making his first pot. And that's very much like what seems to be happening in this picture. And here's the master potter these are going to become water vessels. And he's claimed to make 100 of these shapes before lunch that day, every day. So you can imagine how hard this boy is working to prepare the clay and how hard the potter is working. Here's another similar clay making process. This is in Leborn, but this gentleman is doing basically the same thing. He's mined his own clay, he slakes it down in France. And he's pushing it through a window screen to get the rocks and roots out of the clay, and putting it on that yellow tarp to kind of allow it to dry and become workable. And contrasting that to how most of our institutions make clay, or even industrial processes where you buy clay already processed, it comes air floated or screened so that there are no rocks or impurities, and you get it in 50 pound bags on semis or trucks or trains, and using heavy machinery to process the clay. There's a pug mill. You can see in the background there's the plastic loaves of clay ready to be used. Here's the industrial clay making machine. Here they got a huge pug mill that's mixing this clay and extruding these long lugs of clay, which are then put into machines. Maybe I have a picture later on of how they process this. But this material clay, the most abundant material on the surface of the earth, and found almost everywhere on the surface of the earth too. If you were able to dig down far enough, eventually you'll find clay. It's made out of silica and alumina. 75% of the Earth's crust is silica and alumina. Anyway, back to the history of pottery. I was trying to kind of get on these tangents and talk about forming clay, and talking mostly about pottery and what man has done with clay, imparting his energy into this material and making it unique. The different processes of forming the clay here is pinching, pinch pop, is kind of turning the pot and pinching, squeezing the clay. Here's a Pueblo Indian, Lucy Lewis, and she's doing a similar process, coiling and pinching and making these pots by hand. Most of the pots throughout history have been made by women. This is in Jamaica. And these seemingly perfect pots then are made by hand without any kinds of machine. Here she's polishing the outside surface so that when it's fired it will tend to have a shiny surface. And wheel throwing, what I enjoy most is working on the wheel. Sort of like a pinch pot, although it's spinning on a machine on the wheel, and it kind of, with water, it slips through your hands and you can speed up the process. Squeezing the clay. This is a Korean potter. Very different wheel. Kind of wheel. You can see he's making a bowl off of that large mound of clay. He's going to make several bowls out of that one mound of clay. Here's back to that factory in Figgjo, Norway. Figgjo porcelain factory. And here are these machines making plates and dishes. Five of them simultaneously, and it takes about 30 seconds to make a plate. So it's no longer necessary for man to make plates and dishes and bowls to eat out of. Machines can make them hundreds of times faster. But for some odd reason, we still, more than ever before, find the need to make pottery by hand. Here's another process, slip casting, which most all of the pottery we see today is made out of slip cast clay, poured liquid clay in plaster molds, filling up the mold, and then after maybe 10 minutes or 15 minutes pouring out the excess liquid, and there is a shell has been created inside that mold, which will be the form. All of our toilets, sinks, bathtubs, that kind of object is what the archaeologist is one day going to find, are made out of slip cast, are made with slip casting process. The production factory, and here are some of the wares that were made in those molds. Okay. This is some of the oldest pottery known to man, is Jomon pottery. It dates back some 25,000 years BC in Japan. To me, it looks almost contemporary. The Western world and Western history, we know a great deal about pottery making around the Mediterranean world, but only more recently is this older pottery being discovered in parts of China and Japan. Jomon means cord roughening, and that's a term that was given to describe this kind of ware. It's made hand-built processes and using rope, pressing rope on the clay to give this texture and decoration. Some of these forms, as old as they are, some 25, 27,000 years old maybe, look very much like pots that are still being made today. It's kind of an irony in a way that you would think things progress, but the making of pottery is something that is unique, that it seems to never change, and that every person working with clay sort of starts out with the same kind of beginnings and the same sort of ideas. To make this vessel shape a container, something out of clay. A dark slide, but very peculiar pots. Highly decorative. Very textured surface. Keep in mind that most of the historical pots are pots that have survived because they've been recovered from tombs, almost most of the time taken from burial tombs or unearthed, but they've been protected because they've been in underground or in tombs. But most of the pots have some sort of ceremonial qualities. The pots that were used for everyday use were usually used until they broke, and then they would either discard them or crush them up and add them back to the next clay that they made. These are very unusual figures, and in such perfect condition, which again shows or demonstrates the durability of fired clay, its longevity, how it can last so long and not deteriorate. Much of the early pottery that archaeologists find seem to be fertility figures or figures of women. Perhaps some sort of deity that was worshipped. The whole idea of having babies or fertility was very important, probably one of the most important things that they thought of. So this is the kind of thing that even predates the making of pottery. Pottery being vessels that you would use to eat out of. So much of these strange style, strange kind of ritualistic figures, which in some ways to me resemble modern contemporary sculpture. Here's kind of a vessel, kind of a pottery vessel shape that's decorated as a woman figure, fertility figure. This is a beautiful Egyptian piece, probably about 4000 BC. Some they think of a bird deity of some sort, but a beautiful, simple, graceful form on the red earthenware clay. The Egyptian pot, very little pottery, or when you think of Egypt, you don't think much about their pottery, you think of other materials. And so there's very few Egyptian pots to study. The whole, it's about 2500 BC, painted with gazelles probably. This piece, being so old, still resembles very much Pueblo pottery, or pottery that might even still be being made in various parts of the world. Egyptian pottery, this is a small form, it's probably about 4 or 5 inches tall. They were thought to be some of the first to use actual applied glazes. And although it's not, maybe not quite actually an applied glaze, it's sort of a self-glazing clay, but they were able to mix up a concoction, and as the water dried out, the clay deposited a glaze-like material on the surface, and then after being fired, you would get this shiny surface. So the Egyptians get credit for the first glazed with a glass coating, first glazed pottery. And this piece is beautifully repaired. It has a gold hand. And throughout history in many different cultures, you could see repairing done with gold. They didn't have super glue and things like that. And this enhances the piece and makes it even more special that it's repaired with gold. There's some small hippopotamus forms. The same sort of material, it's kind of a self-glazing clay body. About the same time, this is about 2500 BC, we have some pottery made in what will later become Greece. This is Minoan pottery. The Minoans, it's probably actually more 1500 BC, in that time period. Minoans were seafaring people, very closely connected to the water, the ocean, and the sea. And most of their pottery is very wonderful, bold brush lines and aquatic life. It's beautiful how these dolphins are just swimming and jumping. It's some sort of a bathing dish. There are many different versions of the octopus jar, which some people say that they can catch octopus. They can get in this jar. Maybe it was a very special animal to them. Maybe it was just a beautiful decoration that seems to, the tentacles seem to encompass this form very beautifully. There are many different versions of that. Old one. Now these are all unglazed pottery. It's a polished clay. They use what's called a terra sigillata. It's actually just a kind of refined clay slip, painting it on and by kind of buffing it with a rag or smooth cloth or whatever, you can polish it and it becomes reflective so that it appears glaze-like, but it's not fired hot enough to melt glass. The Minoan people were very friendly, peaceful sort of people they've been described as. Sea-loving people. To the north of them, this is a Minoan goddess, snake goddess. This dates about 2000 BC, I believe. I hope there are no historians in here, because I'm more interested in the progression of ceramic techniques and processes. Sometimes my dates get a little bit around. Here's some Minoan writing, clay tablets. You've heard of clay tablets. And these are beautiful things to me because they're just kind of random. It might be the day's sales, it might be a message to a friend, who knows what it might be, but real obscure sort of objects that tell you a lot about how they thought. And it's the beginning of written language. It's very important. And that clay was the material, the vehicle, that they could take a soft pad of clay, scratch into it, and then fire it, and it was a permanent message. Whether or not you can decipher this, I think it's a beautiful record of man's existence. Some 4,000 years old now. Mycenaean people lived in close proximity to the Minoans, and this is a famous, called the Warrior Base, Warrior Crater. This is about, I want to say 18,000 BC, but here we have some warriors that are going off to fight the Dorians, and the Mycenaeans were never successful in beating off the Dorians. Here we have these warriors kind of a little bit unsure, they're not very happy about going to battle. We have a woman on the left-hand side with her arms up in the air, and she's kind of sobbing as these warriors are going off. So we have a lot of pottery being made that depicts historical events and occurrences. Those two civilizations kind of combine and form the Greek culture. This is an early Greek base, probably about 1800 BC. The early pots, the archaic Greek pots, were very austere, very plain, reserved, very little decoration. simple banding, dip, and decoration. It's a very famous vase called the Diplion vase. It's about 1600 BC. And here we finally have the introduction of human figures. There's a funerary procession happening here where there's in the middle you can see a sarcophagus or a coffin and some stick figures which are in procession. This piece is almost 5 feet tall. I've seen it in the National Museum in Greece. It's hard to believe it's that large. And that in itself shows an incredible knowledge of clay and the ability to make large vessels.
How wide across is that then?
I'm sorry, what?
How wide across is it?
How wide? Gosh, it must be 4 feet around. It's 5 feet tall, 3 feet around, or diameter 3 feet. It was a funerary base. Here we finally have, you know, a little more bold use of figures, some chariots.
You will tell me.
Black on kind of a buff colored background. Horses, very important. This is the introduction of horses. This piece comes from about 6th century BC. It's a black on white, black on red. And it's depicting some battle scene. I can't tell you all the names, but often these figures have names and they're written on the bases. Notice that these figures are still kind of in profile. They're still kind of difficult for the artist to render a freestanding full-life figure. They're kind of, very few things are overlapping. They're kind of very rigid forms. This is the other side of that. This is Pericles, I think, and Ajax are playing a game. It's during a lull of the battle at Trojan, I think, the siege of Trojan. This is about 5th century BC. Well, a lot of these characters can be identified by scholars and they know exactly, you know, all these mythological figures. They can tell a great deal, or have been able to determine a great deal of the Greek culture because of its pottery. A lot of these vases were made to depict athletic events, sometimes a battle or the death of a person. Often they were like trophies. They certainly weren't used in everyday eating and drinking. Some of the, my favorite place is the British Museum, which has probably one of the finest collections of Greek pottery. A little, probably a bit more elaborate battle happening. In this piece, and it's a little bit difficult to make out, but the figures are actually kind of three-quarter view. There's a lot more realism to the depiction of the figures. And some scholars think that it was about the 4th and 5th century BC that man suddenly got this new kind of understanding of how to render dimension, how to draw with perspective. This kind of perspective doesn't occur up until about that time. It's sort of maybe the point I'm trying to make is that pottery tells us a lot about the history of our existence, and we can see almost specific things, different realizations that can occur through looking at pottery. Here, these figures, we have sort of a three-quarter view and a lot more realism. Part of the reason we have so many of these fine examples, and they're, most of them actually came from Italy, they were exported to Italy from Greece, was William Hamilton, who came from, he was an ambassador from England to Italy, and he spent most of his time unearthing tombs and taking the Greek pottery vases you can see in this depiction, this drawing. They're taking them all back to England, to the British Museum. So that's why they were preserved so well, is because they were funerary objects that were buried with the deceased. The view of the British Museum has so many of these Greek painted vases that they can't even display them properly. Some of them are stacked way above your head, but it's just incredible to see these 2,000 or 3,000 year old pieces in such exquisite condition. The fall of Greece and the Romans take over, and we have some. The Romans were very clever. I don't have any examples of Roman pottery, but here's a molded piece. It's a kind of a depicts a story or a hunt, such as the Greek painted vases made. But here it's in relief. They had a mold of the outside surface of this ball, pushed clay into that mold so they could duplicate or mass produce this shape. And it's covered with a black slip, similar to the Greek pots. The Romans are very good. They're very eclectic. They took ideas from everyone they conquered. Some of these pots look very contemporary. Slip decoration. This one is a Roman pot, 2,000 years old, and it looks just like something that might be made in a pottery class today, where somebody pushing their fingers from inside out in the soft clay. The fall of the Roman Empire and the fall of so many things were lost. Here's the pottery making about the 8th century AD. Very, very crude. Glazes were still kind of unclear. They didn't know how to make glazes. Firing was very crude and primitive. We have very few pots to examples from these time periods. The Dark Ages indeed were dark. The whole idea of building kilns was nearly lost. An example was the Romans knew how to make cement. They knew how to calcine gypsum and make cement and make clay bricks and mortar them together, such as we built houses today. That whole idea was lost with the fall of the Roman Empire and not rediscovered until about the 1700s, to how to make cement. None of the Gothic cathedrals have a speck of cement. They're all cut stone. Here's some examples of 8th century medieval jugs glazed with lead glazes. They figured they could sprinkle galena dust or lead litharge on the pots, fire them, it would make a shiny surface. However, to do this required a very sophisticated firing process, so kilns and designs and techniques go hand in hand with making the pottery. And so by just knowing that you can't just fire a glazed piece in a bonfire, you have to have a very special design kiln and a very carefully controlled firing to achieve this effect. So they were slowly rediscovering and discovering new techniques. This is about a 9th century jug, base jug. Still very crude. You can sort of imagine this lead dust being sprinkled on there and then fired. It's about 9th century, and the whole idea of glazes probably came from China through the Islam world, through Persia, into Italy and Spain. So it's an Italian Renaissance, or Italian Miolicaware, pre-Renaissance. And here they're trying to copy the porcelains found in China with a white slip, making this red clay white, and trying to kind of get a white clay body, even though they only knew how to fire low temperature red clay. But at low temperatures, they were capable of producing a wide palette of colors. And we have, this is about 12th century Italian miolica, which means they're putting a color on top of a white glaze, and depicting battles. A little more friendly scene here. Some of these paintings on pottery were done by some of the famous painters of the day. The Rubens, this next one. Not the next one, maybe the next one wrong, but these pots and the decoration go hand in hand with the paintings done for royalty. And as through most of history, all of pottery making was pretty carefully guarded secrets. Glaze formulas were very, very carefully kept. They had factories working where no one was allowed to escape. Here's one that has these Rubenesque sort of figures, these little cupids in here, sort of very much like Ruben paintings. Very highly decorative, almost so decorative that they were more just gifts to the royalty. Certainly not used for everyday eating and drinking. He's looking down into a bowl. And I'm sorry, I can't tell you very much about what these are, but more the fact that in the 16th century, Italians had a very good knowledge of ceramic chemistry and glaze colorants. Many of these same pigments are pigments that were used in oil paints, cobalts, or maybe the umbers, the coppers, some of the metals that are used in painting as well as in ceramics. It's kind of jumping around because it isn't impossible to try to incorporate everything chronologically. Now we're back in China, and this is a Hanwha figure. This is about 2600 BC. And the pottery making in the Orient progressed at a much more rapid rate than anywhere else in the world. China and Japan have long since been ahead. In fact, 1500 years ahead of Europe as far as their pottery making goes, and the application of glazes and high temperature fire clay. As with many other cultures, the human figure is made. Man has this need to make his image. And being made out of clay, they take on their own kind of spiritual quality, or in this case, sort of a power that this warrior has. He's fully equipped with sword, weapons, armor. This I kind of threw in, it gives you an idea of what their houses might have looked. This is a house that was included in a burial in a tomb, but it's well over maybe 4,000 years old. And to think that, you know, not that much has changed in how houses are built, with a roof, a slanted roof, and architects try as hard as they can to come up with new ideas, but some ideas are very, very old, and because it's made out of clay, we can get an idea of what it may look like. Here's some Shang Dynasty pottery. This dates about 2000 to 1500 BC. And this piece looks maybe very similar to some other pots I've shown, and maybe even similar to some Pueblo pottery. That this kind of what's called polychrome glaze It's just different oxides painted on it, polished, burnished, and fired that gives it sort of a glaze-like look to it. It's very common throughout the world, in all parts of the world, occurring about the same time period of around 2000 BC. Some people think that pottery was discovered in one part of the world, but it seems to occur simultaneously in many different parts of the world. This piece to me looks as though it could be a Pueblo pot, but it's actually a Han Dynasty, a Shang Dynasty pot, probably close to 4,000 years old. And skipping through, this is a Tang Dynasty. This is about 5th century AD, and here we have a glazed figure. The Chinese started using high-fired glazed ware, started to produce high-fired glazed ware about the 1st century BC, making porcelain-like clay. It took the Europeans almost 1,500 years. It wasn't until about the 16th century that the Europeans figured out how to make porcelain when they discovered that the wig powder that they were using was actually kaolin, and that was the material to make porcelain. They tried everything, but the Chinese kept it such a carefully guarded secret that the making of porcelain took a long, long time for the rest of the world to discover. Here's a classic Song Dynasty vase. This is about 9th century to 11th century AD, China. This is a Southern Song carved decoration, high temperature porcelain, very high temperature, extremely high fired piece, very durable glaze. This piece, being well over 1,000 years old, still looks virtually as if it just came out of the kiln. And their technology of firing at these extreme temperatures might possibly be related to our space travel, as far as how the technology that they had compared to the rest of the world. It's beautiful, simple shapes. It's a dragon spinning around a jar. This is a tea storage jar. Tea was important, very tradable commodity, and they would export it in these very beautifully decorated jars. At the same time period, and this is jumping around again, this is the kind of pottery being made in southwest New Mexico, some Mimbres pots. So it's really possible to do justice to the history of ceramics other than just to expose you to lots of different kinds of pottery. These are Mimbres pots made about the 11th century AD, a culture that existed for only about 200 years, and scholars think that there's some of the finest pottery ever made in North America. All of these pots seem to have holes, and for years, archaeologists were repairing the pots, trying to patch up these broken parts, and then it later discovered that it was part of a burial ceremony, that the deceased were buried in the floor of the house that people lived in. This mold was placed over their head, and during the burial ceremony, a hole was broken to let the spirit escape. These pots have some very interesting stories, which very little is known, and you can only kind of imagine maybe what's happening. Part of their religion was the Tiwa religion. They believed man came out of a hole in the ground, and before the colonists came, the Europeans came, he was capable of transforming himself into other animals. He could become a hawk and fly around, or he could become a fish and swim in the water. Maybe that's depicting this sort of religion, that they can transform themselves into various other beings. These bowls are only about 6 inches in diameter, 6 to 8 inches in diameter, and extremely delicate, fine lines. They've only been more recently discovered, and this is how they're digging these pots out of the burial areas, just bulldozing through, and if they see some kind of come up, they grab them. Very few, if any, of these pots are in public museums. They've all been found in our private collections. Very little is known about these pots, and they were only first discovered in 1920. And still, they're finding there are probably only 1,000 of these pots in existence. But very important pottery objects as far as the history of ceramics goes. Some of these beautiful little balls. There he's wrestling with a snake. To decorate an inside curve of a wall is a very complex surface. As you turn these balls and look around, the distortion that happens enhances these pieces. Here, kind of an ambiguous plane. You can maybe imagine a shadow coming from two light sources as this little elk or whatever, this little animal is standing somewhere. Here is being swallowed by a fish or maybe being birthed by a fish. You can only imagine. This is a Peruvian pot. It's probably about 5th century AD. Very little is known about South American pottery. There's very little excavation has occurred there. We have fine examples coming from Peru. We have the classic stirrup bottles, supposedly drinking bottles, perhaps more ceremonial. A lot of portraiture vases like this, probably of the deceased and buried with them. It's Indian. These are all about 1,500 years old now. Beautiful. Very well preserved. Again, anything made out of clay seems to have that ability to withstand the test of time. Strange, these monkeys, very odd sorts of things. You can only kind of imagine what they might have been used for. Again, no glazes, but it's that same sort of terra sigillata glaze-like polished surface that the Greeks used, the Chinese used, the Egyptians used, almost every culture used, and about the same time, very proud standing warrior.
So what kind of temperature would these have been?
Probably about 1600 degrees Fahrenheit, just hard enough to get the clay, high enough to get the clay hardened, it's not vitrified, it's still somewhat porous. And that could be achieved in a bonfire sort of situation. It doesn't take a freestanding kiln to reach 1600 degrees Fahrenheit, but when you go above 2000 degrees, then you have to have a very carefully controlled kiln design. The reason these are low fire clay, that the most common clay on earth is a red earthenware kind of clay, and it, because it has iron oxide in it, it's limited to a lower firing temperature. And almost everywhere on the surface of the earth, there is this low temperature clay occurring. It's actually more economical to fire a lower firing clay, too. That's why our house bricks are made out of the same sort of clay. I don't know very much about these pieces, and I'm not sure that scholars know so much either. They sort of surmise a lot of things. A lot of these figures had to do with people that had illnesses, and this is the jaguar probably depicted here, which is a very important deity in their religion. Some of these strange, this may be a whistle too. They often made sort of this musical pots. Looks like there's a little blowhole or something on the side. Some Mesoamerican made in Mexico. There, some scholars would could tell you all about these. I'm only trying to just show a variety of pieces that are made. These are about 8th century or so AD, somewhere in there. The point about it is that the wheel was not used in North and South America until after the colonists came. And most of the pottery that they find is figurative. Usually they find it in various sites. So their figure is, again, just kind of a female figure. Birthing, fertility was very, very important. These figures have so much power to me. They really are very spiritual, very alive. They tell us a lot about the culture and what they wore and what they thought. Animals. Okay, now I'm kind of skipping ahead to American ceramics. The rest of these slides are going to be about American ceramics. And this is about 1700, when the colonists first start coming to North America and settling, they're bringing with them sort of those Neolica, Italian Neolica ideas of color on top of glaze. These are lead glazed baking dishes. Sort of a rectangular baking dish. Sorry, I got this one backwards. Salt glazing, Salt glazing, they knew at that time that lead glaze was bad, but they didn't have a substitute. And finally, they found the clay deposits that they could build high temperature kilns out of and stoneware clays that were high temperature. They began to produce salt glazed ware, which was high fired. At the top end of the firing, they would introduce salt, like table salt, into the kiln, which would form a pebbly sort of orange peel textured glaze, which was hard and durable. So we get all these kind of buff tone colors, and cobalt blue was almost always the color used for decoration. This pot could be dated as about 1826. Most of these pots had the maker's name stamped in them and where they were made, so it's pretty easy to determine where these are made. Crocks and jugs, not very decorative, very, very functional, purely utilitarian. Very important objects for these people as they began to settle westward. These jugs were all they had that they could use probably for pickling. You couldn't use a wooden bucket very easily for making pickles or storing pickling meats. Pottery container was necessary. Here's a butter churn. The shapes get a little bit more angular. This is a wider base, 1862 obviously. These jugs were very important though. They didn't have plastic, of course, and glass was much too expensive. Wood was a substitute. Pewter was too expensive, and what they had was stoneware jugs, and they carried everything from cooking oil to gasoline or oil, kerosene, maybe water, whiskey, whatever liquid they needed to carry with them was carried in a jug. And as time, this is about Civil War period, 1860s, and we got more competition for sale, so the decorations become more elaborate. It's a 6-gallon crock. A potter would typically make 100 gallons of ware a day, so he probably would get 6 gallons, and, I don't know, 18 of these or so a day, and get about 10 cents a gallon. Get a good day, maybe.
How much clay would a 6-gallon
jar? These were pretty heavy, sturdy sort of things. I kind of enjoy the sturdiness of these things. They're almost too heavy to lift. Probably 30 pounds. Here we've got stenciling and some handwork. This is about 1895. We've got a red wing jar that's mostly machine made, only the handle is handmade and that 5 is hand decorated. But this is a good example of the whole industrialization that occurs and the death of the handmade pottery business. Machines come and people then suddenly want machine made objects. They're just cheaper and better, mostly, more often. We have the introduction of what some people call art pottery in America. This is Wilkwood pottery. It's about 1895 when some women start to get together. It was certainly inappropriate for men to deal with this, but women throughout history have been the pottery makers, and they're the ones responsible for the whole kind of rebirth of art pottery in America. Some of these pieces won awards at the World's Fairs. World's Fair in Paris, some of these pieces won awards. Some people have collected Wilkwood pottery. It's purely decorative, not really meant to be usable, but it's purely decorative, using traditional shapes. Groovy pottery, high-fired. These potteries are in Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, Northeast Park. This is a piece, 1942, some art pottery. Up until this time, pottery is traditional shiny glazes. And here you can recognize some of the world leaders at the time. They're all riding this wild bull. Victor Dragon Scoff. This is Marjorie Gotell. Got pottery making after the war. Very few potteries knew how to fire high temperature. And anybody that had a kiln, in fact, was, as far as art pottery was, because people would flock there and try to learn how to make pottery. Most of the pottery was being made by machines. It's experimentation with glazes, Beatrice Wood. This is a piece actually painted by Picasso. These are about 1950s now. I'm going to concentrate a lot on the, kind of the emergence of contemporary ceramics. Important figure is Soji Hamada, and Bernard Leach is another very important figure in the early 1920s through the 40s. Bernard Leach went to Japan to study pottery and met Soji Hamada, who kind of reintroduced or restarted the pottery, folk pottery tradition, which had almost been lost, that you could make your own pottery, decorate your own pottery, and fire your own pottery, sell your own pottery, because factories had taken over the making of pottery and there was very little handmade pottery to be had. This is a piece by Bernard Leach. It's about, it's fairly contemporary, 1970s, but it sort of typifies the whole idea of this folk pottery again, that handmade pottery.